This is a Doxcast, not an Argos Soxcast, or a Bagels and Loxcast. Now I'm hungry. This is a Doxcast. It's a nerdy Toxcast. Discuss a Moxcast with Rich Early and friends.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another three-point episode of the Doxcast. I am your co-host, Josh Trumbo, and with me, as always, is Mr. 300, Rich Early. Rich, how are you doing tonight?
Josh, you're trying to punt this episode already, aren't you?
I was going to leave the puns out of it, but if you want to just dive right in, it's our 300th episode, Rich, of the Doxcast.
When 2011, you weren't even on them. You made the theme song, and then we wouldn't even let you on, right?
Well, that's pretty much how it happened. We heard a few episodes, Paul and I, and we said these guys need a theme song because. You know, who has a podcast and just starts talking without the theme song? And so we made one for you, and we forced you to use it, I guess. I still don't know how that worked out. But yes, I wasn't an official member of the podcast for the first several years.
My favorite thing I think that still ever happened on the podcast is we used to have a guy from South Africa who randomly followed the Doxcast, and you can see him in the statistics. And it was just like, what is going on? So, let's get to our guests. Like, we are really happy and honored to have this is our first ever actual NFL player, Josh.
Can you
believe that we have an NFL player on?
Well, you know, that's not the first thing you think of when you think of a nerdy podcast. At least most people don't. I don't know. Maybe you do, because you're a nerd and you love football.
So setting him up just a little bit, he has a career quarterback rating. It's nearly perfect at 120, which is an awesome stat.
That's impressive.
He has over 27,000 yards. I'm not saying of what. I'm just saying yards.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I want to introduce to you former Seattle Seahawk, Minnesota Viking, and Oakland Raider, and I don't think I missed anybody, and UCLA Bruin, Chris Cluey. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how's it going? the 27,000-yard one really caught me off guard.
You very patiently waited for us to get through all of that without bursting into laughter. I'm very impressed.
According to your wiki page, you have like 27,300 and some odd punting yards combined. Not all at once, but
total. I mean, that would be amazing if it was all at once. The ball would explode.
Yeah. 27,000 yards straight up. Just
yep.
Not even horizontal, just right into space. It's orbiting the Earth to this day. It's just...
Oh, man.
Chris, well, okay, so we met Chris. I'll just say how we met you, and then I just want you to introduce yourself a little bit. Chris is playing... can I say how I met you? Is that all right?
Of course. I am a gigantic nerd. Do
not He is playing Dungeons & Dragons with a good friend of the of Paradoxes and the show, Lance Undead Viking Meister. A lot of people are very familiar with him as a... You know, he lives up here. He's a big board game reviewer and now works for various board game companies. And,
Gray Fox
and
Games,
somehow, Gray Fox Games, and somehow has got to play Dungeons and Dragons with one of my all time favorite Vikings. So how did that happen?
Yes, seems like a AMC special, right? So I actually met Lance at Board Game Geek Con. I think it was either 2016 or 2017, I want to say, because I designed a tabletop card game called Twilight of the Gods. And so I was hanging out, doing demos at the booth, and Lance stopped by and, you know, had his Viking shirt on, and we, you know, we talked Vikings, talked board games, and he's just a cool dude. And so kept in contact. And then I think it was probably about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago. He does his weekly podcast, the Alaboom, And one of his co-hosts just sent me like a random invite, like, hey, you want to come on and talk? And I'm like, of course I do. I'm not doing anything else. There's a pandemic. So, and then, got done with that. And then Lance is like, hey, like, I run a D&D session. You know, would you want to join? I'm like, of course I want to join. We're currently in a graveyard where things are trying to kill us. Lance is doing his level best to murder the party, but somehow we're surviving. So
as a good DM should.
Right? Yeah.
So what are you playing right now? I gotta know. So
I had a lot of fun with this character's backstory. So growing up, me and my friends, we had tried to play D&D several times, but none of us really ever wanted to be the GM, right? Mm-hmm. So it's very hard to have a D&D campaign with no GM. So the character I came up with, he's a drow cleric who has been possessed by the elvish god of light. Drow, with as anyone who's familiar with D&D know, do not like light. They do not like fire. Those are bad things. And so the reason why this elvish god of light possessed him is because the god mispronounced the name of his next high acolyte at the ceremony. And instead of getting the what was supposed to be the high acolyte, instead got my character, who was in the middle of his 100th birthday celebration, celebrating his, ascension to adulthood in drow society. Mm-hmm. But instead he's shooting light out of his hands and everyone's screaming and running.
I would watch that show. I would absolutely watch that.
So yeah, I had a lot of fun creating the character.
Are they going to draw on that character in the upcoming D&D movie that they might finally make?
I would be about to do it. But basically, my character's entire motivation is to get this god out of his head so he can go back to being an evil drow.
Awesome. That's a super nice tension, right? Because like the rest of the party doesn't want that to happen.
Right, yeah. And the other thing is, so I have him set up to where he's constantly arguing. So he can hear this elvish god like speaking in his head, but no one else can hear the god speaking in his head. So the rest of the party is convinced that he is just like completely around the bend. But he occasionally heals people. Not because he wants to, but because he's forced to.
I can tell right away, right, that you have got a deep imagination and a long creative history. And you mentioned already that you designed a card game, and we're going to talk about that. And then you also recently have published, well, you just published your second, right before the pandemic, which you pointed out pre-show was good timing.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited to get into your brain about the creative process behind those. But from an NFL perspective, I just like, this is how people know you most. Right. And so I guess I'm wondering, do nerd and punter go hand in hand? Is that like where you end up in the NFL?
It's funny you said that because punters and kickers are always kind of viewed as like apart from the team, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is that delineation is very, very prevalent in high school. It lessens a bit once you get into college, and then once you get into the NFL, it's almost completely gone. Because when you're in the NFL, everyone who's there understands, okay, we're here because we have a job to do, and that's to win football games. So we keep getting paid, so we continue to have our jobs. So, as long as you're not a complete douchebag, like, you can get along with just about anyone in the locker room. During my time in the NFL, I spent time in the locker room painting war machine miniatures in the middle of the locker room. And I had some questions from my teammates about what I was doing. I'm like, and I would gladly explain to them, and then they would shake their heads and walk away.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of you, and I don't know if you put them out or the Vikings or Wizards, but you had gotten a bunch of magic starter kits. It's driving me nuts because I remember the product, but I can picture it and I can't say the name.
The Commander Starter Decks.
Sure, and you were playing, and that was just really cool. Is all I'm saying.
I think the one that got the most traction was Wizards had sent me a couple Commander Starter Decks because I got like super into Commander because I had a bunch of old cards. I was like this is the only way I'm going to be able to use my old cards. And so I'm in the locker room, like the package got sent to the locker room. So I open them up and Adrian Peterson was there at the time. I'm like, hey, you want pose with this, starter deck real quick. I'm going to take a picture. And so I put them on Twitter and all of a sudden everyone was like, does Adrian Peterson play Magic? And I was like, no, he doesn't play Magic. I just had to pose with it because it would be funny.
Yep. So yeah, and did you what? Well, okay. So the two sides of this, right? Like you played Magic early on. You were born in like 81, right? So Magic came out the same year my store opened. Magic debuted at Gen Con that summer, about 2 months. So that was, and it's just always been part of the history at our store. When did you discover Magic? Like, how early were you a nerd? I guess is question.
Good question. I started playing Magic revised, I think, so not the black bordered cards. That was when they shifted to white bordered, but yeah, it was like I got super excited when the first pack of Magic I opened had a Force of Nature and Lord of the Pit.
Wow,
these are amazing.
I think I got a pirate ship.
Right. when me and my friend and my brother like first started playing Magic, like we had no idea what any of the rules did. Like we thought sorceries like stayed in play.
Oh like, wow.
Same with instants. Like we're like, okay, I'm gonna play this giant growth and it just stays there. it was definitely a bit of a learning curve at first, because God, I must have been what, like 11, I think, at the time, 10 or 11, 12 maybe. But yeah, it was, I just remember like looking at these cards and being like, this is so cool. Like, this is so much fun. And I convinced my parents to buy me boosters all the way up until, I want to say Mirage. I think I stopped playing around Mirage. Just because at that point it was like, they kept introducing all these new mechanics like flanking and then, slivers and shadow and like all that stuff. And I was just like, oh, I don't want to have to keep buying packs to stay current. But then I came back when in, I think it was like 2008 or 2009. So I had been playing War Machine at Tower Games in Minnesota, in southern Minneapolis. And the guys there, they were really big into War Machine and Warhammer. But like they also told me about this new Magic format that was called Commander. It was EDH at the time, right? Like Elder Dragon Highlander. Yep. And so I was like, whoa, that sounds really, really cool. Because I didn't want to have to, pay to keep up with Modern. But I also, I still loved Magic. I was like, I love the idea of this deck building game that you duel against someone else. And so Commander got me hooked back in, like, immediately. I was just like, oh, I can use all these old cards that I have. Unfortunately, I gave away a lot of my old cards to a cousin, like, including, like, a whole bunch of dual lands. at the time, I was going into college, and my parents were like, hey, your cousin Tyson wants these cards. Do you mind if we send them? I'm like, I don't care. Send them the cards. And then looking back, you're like, oh yeah, those were probably worth some money. But I mean, they were also used cards because we like to play with them.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But I've been playing.
I'm sorry. And I know you didn't. You said you're not a big comic book nerd. What did you do? Other were you into D&D early, movies, video games? Like what was the what were you doing?
Yeah, so for me growing up, I love reading books. Like I still love reading. I actually have a side gig as a reviewer at Lightspeed Magazine, where every 3 months, like I'll do my review of science fiction fantasy books that are coming out. And I've always been very fortunate in that I can read very, very fast. Like usually a 350 page book will take me about 2.5-3 hours to get through. So like I just devoured books, and my parents had so many books in their house. And you know, as a kid, it was great because like I could just go to their library and just pull something down and read it. And, you know, a lot of the classics, like they had obviously J.R.R. Tolkien, you know, The Hobbit and, you know, the Lord of the Rings. Isaac Asimov, which I didn't really understand as a kid, but once I read it as an adult, I'm like, whoa, this is amazing. Like, I understand this. And, you know, a lot of like Hardy Boys, Tom Swift, stuff like that. So, yeah, from a very young age, I was fully immersed in nerdy stuff. And then I think probably the real turning point was when I want to say I was like 8 or 9. I was at a birthday party at SeaWorld back before we knew that they were mistreating the orcas. And that's why the orcas ate people. So I was at a birthday party there and I'm, you know, running around having fun with my friends. And I split the inside webbing between my big toe and the second toe on my foot open. And I had to have stitches on it. And I couldn't walk on it for like 4 to 5 days because I had, you know, you had to let the wound heal. And so I was driving my parents nuts and they're like, we need to calm our child down. How are we going to calm our child down? And so the hot new thing at the time was the Nintendo Entertainment System. And so they bought me an NES with that combo pack with, you know, Super Mario Brothers and Duck Hunt. Mm-hmm. And I was hooked. Like that was from that point forward. I'm like, I am playing video games. These are amazing.
Which propelled you to that career on Video Games Weekly on KTN,
yes,
too, right?
Exactly. Yeah. No. So the thing is my parents also had a they had a rule that if it was light outside, you had to be outside doing something. And I also really liked sports because I was good at them. You know, I was fortunate enough to have you know, genetics that allowed me to run fairly quick and, you know, good hand eye coordination, all that stuff. And I liked winning. You know, it's same thing in board games and in video games. Like I like to win. I'm a very competitive person. And I knew my parents weren't going to let me sit inside in the couch all day like I wanted. So I was like, okay, well, if I'm going to play these sports, like I want to be really good at them. And yeah, ended up making it to the NFL. So it worked out for me.
Well, and you've had plenty of other success. You were in a top WoW guild, right?
Yes. Yeah. The Flying Hellfish on Kil'jaeden, the Kil'jaeden realm. So I will say, if you are trying to balance a career in the NFL and a career in a raiding guild that is on West Coast time when you're on Central time and they start raiding at midnight your time, it can lead to some sleepless nights.
That makes sense. So moving ahead a little bit. So was there ever a point, because you went to UCLA, and was that on, did you have a athletic scholarship? Did you have other intentions? Like where were you headed and how much of it was your nerd side versus your athletic side?
Yeah. So, in high school, I was, so I only started playing football, because I needed a fall sport. So growing up, I played baseball and soccer. Like those were my sports. And I figured I was either going to get a scholarship as a pitcher or as a goalie. Because I was pretty good at both of those. And then freshman year, in California, soccer is a winter sport and baseball is a spring sport because obviously there's no snow here. So we can play sports year round. And I was like, I don't really want to do, you know, kind of the normal PE classes in fall. And I don't want to do cross country because that's a lot of running. I guess I'll try out for the football team because I can kick a soccer ball real far. I'll try to be a kicker. Little did I know there's a lot of running in football too.
Yeah.
So, but I tried out for the team, made it on the freshman team as is the, you know, the punter, kicker, field goal, like everything. And then my sophomore year, I tore my ACL in my first and last tackling drill that I ever did. And so my junior year, coming back from ACL injury, played really well, got all CIF. And then my senior year, I was an All-American and I got a full ride athletic scholarship to UCLA. And at that point, I was like, okay, like football seems like this could be something that will pay the bills for me going forward, but I know I'm going to have to commit to it. Like this is something I'm definitely going to have to work towards. But at the same time, in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, if I work hard at, you know, getting good at football, that seems like a dream job, right? Like they're going to pay me millions of dollars to kick a football. Like, why wouldn't I work hard at this?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, so the reason I picked UCLA, I actually had quite a few offers from different colleges, but I wanted to go to UCLA because it was far enough away from my parents where, you know, it would be like a trip for them to come visit me because they lived in Seal Beach, which is about 35 minutes with no traffic on the 405, about an hour and a half with traffic. But I knew it was also, okay, if I needed to come down on the weekend to wash some clothes, like, it wouldn't be that bad.
Yep.
It's a typical college experience.
All right.
Awesome. Yeah, and I think I saw on your wiki page you were undrafted, and then the Seahawks picked you up, right? Like,
yeah, so my senior year at UCLA, so I only actually played my last 2 years at UCLA. I redshirted my freshman year and then was on the bench for the next 2 years after that because the guy ahead of me, Nate Fixie, he had been the all Pac-10 first-team punter, like, the year that I got there. And I understood at the time, like, you have to pay your dues, right? You know, if the guy ahead of you is the first-team all Pac-10 punter, like, unless you are just blowing the doors off everyone, you know, you're not going to replace that guy. And I was cool with that because it's like, okay, you know, I'm going to get my chance. Like, I just have to make sure I'm ready. You know, I'm able to perform when I need to. And eventually, like, I will get a chance to, you know, to show what I can do. And so, yeah, I punted for UCLA my junior year and my senior year. And then my senior year, I was a Ray Guy finalist, which is the award they give to the top punter in the nation. Mm-hmm. I think I might have had a chance to win it, except the problem was we played. And again, okay, so at the time, I had no idea about any of the politics involved with, like, voting for these awards or anything. Like, to me, I was just like, oh, I'm up for the Ray Guy Award. Okay, I guess that's cool. Looking back, and said, that was really important. So, anyways, so the week before voting, we're playing Oregon at Oregon, and in that game, I dropped a snap. That, you know, I picked up and had to run, got tackled, and I kicked one. It was a terrible punt. They got returned for a touchdown. So I'm sure all the voters were tuning into the game like, oh, who's this Chris Louie kid? We're going to see what he does. And they're like, oh, this guy sucks. Yeah, like with hindsight, I'm like, oh, that game was really important. but at the time, I was just like, oh man, I didn't do very well. Well, that's a bummer. going into the NFL draft, my agent had told me that the Seahawks were definitely interested in me. Green Bay had kind of come in a little late, like, hey, maybe we'll have room for him. And then San Francisco came in very, very late. They're like, oh, we're thinking about taking him. And so my agent was like, okay, it's pretty likely that you're going to go, like, either, you know, in the sixth or seventh round, or you're going to be an undrafted free agent. I'm like, okay, that's cool. Like, all I need is to get my foot in the door, right? Like, because it, as a punter or kicker, like, the example I always used was Adam Vinatieri, you know, so everyone now knows the name of Adam Vinatieri, right? Like, you know, kicked for the Patriots for a very long time. One of the most successful field goal kickers in the history of the NFL. What a lot of people don't know is that Adam Vinatieri spent his first 2 years, I believe, kicking in the Canadian League because no one would sign him. Like, this is a guy, you know, who he is a Hall of Famer, right? It took him 2 years to make it to the NFL. So in my mind, I was like, okay, like this is a commitment where I might not make it my first year. Like, this is something I'm going to have to work at. But, you know, if I get a chance, I'm going to show them what I can do. And so during the draft, my agent said, yeah, Seattle's been in contact. They want to take you either in the seventh round or as an undrafted free agent immediately afterwards. At the time, I was playing World of Warcraft, so I'm like, yeah, that's cool, just call me. And so, yeah, sure enough, right after the draft ended, 2 minutes later, I get a call from Seattle. They're like, hey, we want to pick you up as an undrafted free agent. You'll get a signing bonus of $3,000. I'm like, sweet, that's more money than I've gotten paid for football in my entire life.
Wow.
Yep. And so, yeah, went to Seattle. And the reason why I went to Seattle, because again, Green Bay and the San Francisco, they were both still showing interest, but in both of those scenarios, it wouldn't have been a legit competition. Like, they had guys who were already there who they knew were probably going to be their starters, whereas Seattle was a full on like open competition. They were looking for a new punter. And so it was between me, Leo Aragus, who was a veteran guy who had punted for the Raiders before, and then Donnie Jones, who had been their punter the year before, but they weren't super sold on him. And actually, I think Donnie is still punting in the league. I want to say he was punting for the Rams. I think he's punting for the Eagles now. But what was interesting was that after the first 2 weeks, they cut Donnie. So he got picked up by another team. And then going after the fourth preseason game, head of personnel called me in and said, hey, we want to keep you on practice squad. Like, we're going to go with Leo as our, you know, as our guy. We think he's, you know, more ready to perform for us, but we think you have potential and, you know, we want to develop that. We want you on practice squad. And I was like, sweet. Like, being on practice squad as a punter, like, is fantastic. It means you still got a chance. Mm-hmm. However, in order to make it to practice squad, you have to clear waivers, which is a 24-hour period where any team can claim you. And we had played Minnesota in our fourth preseason game, and I'd had a really good preseason. Like, I'd been punting really, really well. And we had played Minnesota in our fourth preseason game, and their punters hadn't played very well during the game. I think it was Darren Bennett and Travis Dorsch. And then, so as I am driving to put down a deposit on the apartment in Seattle that me and my wife are going to stay in, I get a call from Seattle's head of operations saying, hey, we need you to come back to the facility. The Vikings just claimed you off waivers. You're flying out in about 5 hours.
Wow.
Wow.
Okay, here's my chance.
I just want to say on a personal level, thank God it wasn't the Packers who, anyway.
I will agree with you because punting outdoors in Green Bay, not my favorite thing to do.
Wow. I mean, this is super. I mean, I'm just a fanboy, so I can listen to you talk all day. But in our pre-show plans, we were going to talk about kind of the creative process. So I don't know, but it all goes together, right? Like, I love the fact that you say you wanted to win. I mean, I assume that still carries on, like, right? Like, if you want to write a book, you want to be really good at it. If you want to make a card game, you want to make a really good card game. It's just got to be a personality thing, right?
Oh yeah, of course. Like, and that was one of the things that my parents instilled in me, like, at a very early age, was that, you know, if you're going to do something, do it to the very best of your ability. And that's a lesson that I have tried to adhere to my entire life, is that, you know, if I choose to do something, like if I'm going to put my time and effort towards, you know, towards engaging in this thing, I am going to do it to the very best of my ability. Like, I do not want to be disappointed with, you know, with what I've come up with. I don't want to feel like I've left anything behind. And so, yeah, when it comes to like writing books or, you know, developing a card game or any sort of game, like I want to know in my heart that I have done the very best that I possibly could have done. And, you know, I'm going to be the first to admit it might not be perfect. Like, it might not be great, but you are going to get everything that I have, because, you know, that way, at least I know I can sleep happy knowing that I've done my best.
So how did you, so post NFL, how did you decide you wanted to make a card game? And this is Josh. If you have questions, Josh, I know I'm asking.
Oh, I'll probably chime in here. But go ahead and answer that one first, and then I'm ready to attack. Let's do this.
Yep. So like I said, I have been playing Magic a very, very long time, and I love Magic. It is an amazing game. There are parts about Magic that I absolutely cannot stand. And the majority of those situations come down to when one person doesn't get to play the game. So, for example, like if you get mana flooded or mana screwed, right? Mm-hmm. Either you have too many lands or you don't have enough lands, you don't get to play the game. You're stuck watching your opponent play the game. When someone takes infinite extra turns in Commander, like, great, I get to sit here and watch you masturbate. How fun for me. like that, to me as a player, as someone who wants to play the game, I am not allowed to play the game and it is no longer fun. Like, that's not a fun experience to me. And so when I was making my card game, I was like, okay, I can complain about this all I want, but how would I solve these problems? Right? Because they are a problem. Like, they are an issue. If one person isn't allowed to play the game, well, then that, you know, that shows you that there's a flaw somewhere along the lines. And if you want to make it better, well, you have to figure out how to solve that issue. And so that led me to developing Twilight of the Gods. Is really the underlying core idea behind it was, how do I make a game that's similar to Magic, which is a game I love? Like, you know, I still love playing Magic. But how do I make it so that it's even more fun in a game that I can play? And every time I play it, I feel like if I won or I lost, it was on my skill as a player versus, oh crap, I got seven mountains on my draw and I can't play anything. So yeah, that was really kind of the underlying impetus for creating Twilight of the Gods.
That's awesome. Of course, as we've been talking about here, and Rich has mentioned, I love board games, very into that, and it's really funny listening to your experience with Magic, because apart from coming back to it, my experience was fairly similar to yours. I got in it revised, and then it was around the time, I think Ice Age, right around there is when I dropped off, because it was just getting to that point where it's like, okay, I don't want the lifestyle. I can't afford the lifestyle of this game. But yeah, and
I was gonna say, like that was one of the other things behind Twilight of the Gods, was that I can't say it's a living card game, because Fantasy Flight has trademarked living card game as a phrase. We are an expandable card game. but yeah, so one of the reasons why I wanted people to know, you know, exactly the cards you were getting in your deck, was that, like, it feels icky to win with your wallet, right? Like if you outspend the other person, I mean, to me, there's too many parallels with what happens in real life for me to feel comfortable with that. If I win as a player, I want to know that it's due to my skill and my ability to play against you as another person, not because I spent more money than you. So that was another big design philosophy for us, was, okay, like people need to know what they're getting. People need to know, you know, like when they play this game, you win or lose based on your skill as a player. Like, it's not because you pulled a better card than the other person.
Right. And that's a very interesting point, because, you know, that was in reading some articles, especially when Richard Garfield developed Keyforge, you know, they talked a lot about it, and that his original idea was, you get some cards and then you just get to be as good as you can with the cards you have. And obviously that's, you know, not what Magic is right now, for better or worse. But it's really cool to have the system that you have. Which is, you know, not a living card game, but
so we wanted to call it an undead card game, just to kind of poke in the eye. But I knew that everyone would think, "Oh, it's a zombie game."
right. But that's really cool to have that, and then it becomes more about being, you know, having a sense of ingenuity. You know, to take the cards that are available and to say, okay, how can I take these? And instead of just going, well, what's the winning deck right now? All right, I'll go and buy those and, you know, stick them in a deck and I'll play and until someone comes up with a better one, and then I'll buy that one, you know?
Right. Like I'm going to spend $2,000 to net deck my opponent.
Yeah.
Just freaking win. Yeah. Well, let me know if I'm rambling, because I can talk about my card game, like, literally for hours.
Because I'm super curious about it. I'm wondering, you know, is it still ongoing? How does it do? Do you, you know, like what, who, I don't know where it was published, nothing. So go for it.
So we were originally published by Victory Point Games. We did a Kickstarter with them, very successful, released our core set that has 4 factions. Then did another Kickstarter for the 3 mini expansions for the core set. Which were new cards along with filling in some of the old cards. Then Victory Point Games got acquired by Tabletop Tycoon. And we got kind of stuck in like development limbo hell of where are you going to slot in into our release schedule. Right as we were getting out of that to where Tabletop Tycoon was, okay, you know, we've got plans. We're going to, you know, set up the Kickstarter. The pandemic happened. So Tabletop Tycoon was like, hey, are you cool if we extend your contract for, you know, another 2 years or so we can like figure out what we're doing? I'm like, yeah, that's fine. Like, I understand the real world kind of came in. But we have another full expansion already, like big expansion with 2 new factions already like built and done. The 3 mini expansions for that are built and done. The next big expansion with 2 additional factions is like 90% done. And then the 3 mini expansions for that is like 75-80% done. When we were building Twilight of the Gods, it was with the idea that we would want to release on like, you know, a 3-4 month schedule because, you know, that's what card gamers like, right? Like, you know, they want to know that there's new stuff coming out. But the other thing that we had in mind was like, okay, how do we release new cards that aren't better cards? Mm-hmm. They're different cards. Because like I feel like that's one of the other issues with Magic is that like Magic is constantly releasing better cards. Like and it becomes a thing where, okay, if you don't pay money to get the better cards, then you get left in the dust. Like you have to buy the better cards. I mean, shoot, you can just look at the equivalent mana cost and power levels of card, you know, modern cards released now versus those released during like beta or revised. Like it is night and day. Like those cards are legit just better cards. Like you could not win with a revised. Sorry, I won't say you could not win. It would be very, very hard to win with a revised deck versus, you know, like a modern deck. Cause there's been power creep and, you know, that happens when you're doing a collectible card game. But, one of the things we wanted to do with the factions in Twilight of the Gods was we didn't like they're color coded, but that's more just a means of kind of differentiating them. The main thing that defines the factions in our game is the philosophy behind the faction. So, for example, like our 4 starting factions are aggression, negotiation, mysticism, and sanctuary. And so basically, like, if you are a player who likes to attack, who likes to, you know, hit to face, like, you, aggression is the philosophy that speaks to you. If you're a player who likes to defend, you like to ford up, you know, and have, like, big defensive creatures and then eventually come out from behind your walls and attack, sanctuary, that's the faction for you. Like, if you're a faction that likes to set traps, you like to, you know, mess around with other players and sort of, you know, subvert their expectations with negotiation, like, that's the faction for you. And so for me, a big part of the design philosophy was how do we allow players to express themselves through our cards? Because I'm, again, huge nerd. I love reading science fiction fantasy. I don't know if you've read any of Ian Banks's stuff, but The Player of Games was a book, a science fiction book he wrote, I think back in like late 90s, early 2000s. And the game that is described in the book essentially allows the people who play it to tell the people or to what's the word I'm looking for? It allows the person playing that game to show what they value, what they think is important, right? Like this is who I am as a person. Like these are the philosophies I think are meaningful, and this is the type of world I want to create. And again, I'm not saying our game is anything close to approaching that, but that's the idea behind it, that as a player, how you express yourself, we should allow you to do that through the cards that we provide to you. And so that's to me is one of the big things behind our design philosophy is like you as a player are always able to be who you are.
So
how do you approach power balance in those structures, right? So everybody's got right. a different philosophy. That's awesome. But how do you make sure that aggression doesn't constantly beat negotiation, you know, or things like that?
Yes, that's a very good question. That's why we were developing it for 5 years. And I will say, if you want to design a card game, a board game, like any sort of game, you need someone like my brother, Greg, who is amazing at breaking things and making them unfun. Because when you introduce a mechanic and Greg says, oh, I'm going to build something around that. And then 2 turns later, you're like, oh my God, I want to flip the table. You know, okay, there's a problem. We need to solve that. So yeah, a lot of the balancing was, you know, was in those iteration years of, okay, here's how we think this faction should play. Like, here's how we'd like this philosophy to express itself. How do we do that in a way that still allows both players to play the game? Mm-hmm. And so yeah, one of the big things we did was that resources in the game, again, can't call it mana. So, for us, it's power. but in our game, the resources are faction agnostic. So to get resources in Twilight of the Gods, the resources are on the back of the cards. So we have tier 1, tier 2, and tier 3. As the tier level goes up, the corresponding card power level goes up. But to use those resources, you have to trade your cards with the other person. Mm. So you're always interacting with the person across from you. And there's a couple other mechanics where if the other person doesn't want to trade, like you can still get cards from each other. But the main thing is that you're always going to be on an equal level in terms of your resources. But it's up to you how you use those resources in order to take on the other person. And with a faction agnostic resource system, like say, for example, you're playing Mysticism, but you really like a particular powerful aggression card. Well, if you as a player, if you want to express yourself that way, there's nothing saying you can't include that card in your deck. Like you absolutely can put that card in your deck and be like, okay, I'm not full Mysticism. Like I'm Mysticism with a hint of aggression, or, you know, I'm half negotiation, half sanctuary. Like I like to be behind my walls, but I also like to kind of mix it up and set some traps out with the other person. Like, and again, that gets back to the kind of the core philosophy of how do you let the player express themselves through these cards?
And that's very interesting because, you know, a lot of like the living card games now, which is a good analogy here. You know, I play a lot of Arkham Horror, the card game. It's cooperative, yep. So it's a different thing. But like that, I played some Netrunner back in the old days and after Fantasy Flight took it over for a little while. And a lot of what they do to keep power creep from happening and those unstoppable combos is creating those factions and basically putting deck restrictions. So if you choose your, you know, your investigator or your personality or whatever, and they have certain restrictions, like you can only play these cards and you can splash 10 of these kind of cards or right. up to level 2 of these cards or something like that. And so with Twilight of the Gods, is it so open? Like you could just include any, you could be an aggressive sanctuary loving negotiator and, you know, throw it all in there, or have you found that putting some restrictions in place is necessary to keep the balance? Or
So we did put some restrictions in place. So in the game, since it is the Twilight of the Gods, who you are playing as is actually a god. Like it is a deity from, you know, from the antiquities of the past. Like, and we're drawn from historical pantheons. So like, for example, like our starter gods are Mars, right, from the Roman pantheon, Hera from the Greek pantheon, Enlil, who was a Sumerian god of like storms and harvest. And then Rito the Portents, who was a druidic god that we made up because no one knows what the druids believed in because they didn't write anything down.
That reminded me of the Spinal Tap song. Nobody knows who they were or what they were doing.
So what we did with the gods is like, and that was something where I also feel like if you're designing a game, like don't be afraid to take ideas from other games, right? Like there are things that other games do that are really, really cool. And it's okay to, I'm not going to say steal those ideas, but like use them to inspire you. So for example, I also played a lot of Hearthstone when it first came out. And I really liked the idea of the hero ability. Like it was okay, cool. Like this kind of defines my deck. Like this is who I am. And as I said earlier, I played a lot of War Machine. And in War Machine, you get a feat turn with your hero where it's like, okay, for this one moment in battle, I get a chance to change the tides. Like I'm going to, you know, reverse things. I'm on the back foot. Boom. Now all of a sudden, like I'm the one in charge. And so in Twilight of the Gods, you are actually playing as a god, and that god has a, you know, once per game ability that you can use. It won't win you the game outright, but it can severely mess with your opponent's plans. However, in order to take a god, you have to meet their conviction level. So there's 50 cards in a deck, and our gods are either a 10 cost, a 25 cost, or a 40 cost. So if you play a god with a 10 cost, that means you have to have at least 10 cards of that god's faction in your deck. So, for example, like if I'm playing a negotiation god that has a 10 cost, I need at least 10 negotiation cards in my deck. The other 40 can be whatever I want. So you can go really, really broad. However, our 10 cost gods' powers tend not to be very powerful, right? Like they're very general. They're, you know, okay, this is like a minor bonus that I can get. The 40 cost gods, so you need 40 of that god's philosophy in your deck. They tend to be really, really good at what that philosophy does. But, you know, the flip side is you only get 10 cards from the other factions. Right. So that was something where we, you know, we saw it was a design choice, but also an opportunity, you know, to reward players for specializing in a certain philosophy. And also, you know, to players who didn't want to specialize in a certain philosophy. Okay, you know, you still get bonuses, but it's going to be a more general bonus. It's not going to be, you know, specific to what this philosophy does.
That's really cool because you could have, say you have a 40 cost god and a 10 cost god, you could have functionally the exact same deck with each of them, where you could have 40 of the one card and 10 of another. But that's really interesting.
Josh, are you back?
Yes, there you are. You disappeared.
Oh, did I?
Yeah, you did.
Oh, yep. Goodness, that's funny because I thought I was saying something really profound. Well, I guess that's what happens.
I mean, you can say it again if you want.
We'll try it. Now that's been built up so much. No, what I was saying is I think that's really interesting because you could have the exact same makeup of a deck between a 40 cost god and a 10 cost, right? Because you'd have 40 of one card and 10 of the other, but it would be different with the power there. I think that's really fascinating. I really like that.
Yeah, exactly. And like, well, and again, it's all about how do we allow the players to express themselves? Like as a game designer, my job is to allow you to play the game in a way that fits you best. Like, and that's something that I feel, I understand why a lot of games limit that because, you know, due to just the kind of constraints of either like the mechanics of the game itself or how it's being presented. But in a deck building card game, there really aren't a whole lot of restraints. Like it is literally like one person versus another person. So if you can give the player ultimate freedom to, you know, to express themselves as a player, like that to me, that's the type of game that I want to play.
So how early on in the design process did you come up with the theme? Because the philosophy seemed to be there from the beginning, where it's finding a way to express you and your play style through the deck that you build. How did you meld that into the theme? Was that kind of just always there, or was it one of those like, well, say it's a bunch of gods, and then that kind of stuck?
Yeah, so it's funny you asked that because the theme came way late. So when we first started, so the design team behind it, so I came up with the original idea, like, you know, and literally this was something I would be at practice with the Vikings, sort of sitting watching practice, thinking in my head, like, okay, how would I solve this problem? So that was like Twilight of the Gods was born of my boredom during film practices. So I came up with this idea, and then I approached my brother because, like I said, he's really good at breaking stuff. I'm like, okay, I have this idea, you know, for a card game. Like, let's kind of sketch out the bare bones of it, and then you tell me, okay, you know, what works, what doesn't. Because, like, I can figure out a lot of what works and what doesn't, but he's, like, he's really good at finding those edge cases. Right. And then, so we were kind of iterating, and then a couple other friends of ours, Justin and Chris, they were regulars at the game store we used to run. Like they got interested in it. They're like, hey, you know, can we get involved? And I'm like, yeah, sure. Like you guys bring, you know, different stuff to the table. Like, that's great. So that was our core design team, the four of us. And so we were, when I originally built it, I had this idea of, like, you know, each faction was based around, like, an element, and, you know, it was called influence, and you were vying for influence to control this continent. And it's basically like what you'd read in, like, a high schooler's, you know, graph paper notebook. I am not ashamed to say it was not great. I was more concerned about the mechanics. really wasn't that worried about, like, okay, what's the coat of paint that's covering the engine? So when we had gotten it to kind of like a playable prototype state, to where we were comfortable with, okay, this is how each faction should play. Like, this feels fun. Like, this feels like a good game. We enjoy playing this. Justin, he had known Alan Emmerich, who was the head of Victory Point Games, because he had taken Alan's class at university for game design. And so he was like, hey, you know, I have this teacher that I gone to, you know, should we show him the game? I think he can give us some feedback. I'm like, yeah, no, that'd be fantastic. And so we set up the meeting, and we showed up at Alan's office. And it was hilarious because, like, when we walked in, you know, when we sat down and started talking with Alan, like, from the first, like, 10 seconds, I could tell, okay, this is like a favor to a former student, right? he's going to hear us out for like 5 minutes, and then, you know, we'll probably be on our way. But then, as you know, as we start going through the mechanics and, like, what the game's about, like, he's like, hold up. I need to call some people to get them in here. Like, they need to see this. And at that point, I was like, okay, we've got a good game. So we went through that, like, you know, kind of explaining everything, what's going on. Alan and his team are, like, looking over it, asking us questions. And then basically, like, at the end of that, Alan was like, okay, you know, I really like what you have, but, you know, the lore, the surrounding of it, like, it doesn't do it for me. Like, it doesn't seem compelling enough. I'm like, okay, that's completely fair. that was not really my first concern. And so we started brainstorming ideas back and forth, and then settled on the idea of, okay, what if, you know, what if instead of some imaginary universe where, you know, no one knows of that this was happening, like, what if it was happening in our world, but what if it was happening during a time of societal collapse, right? Like, so during the, you know, 300, 400, 500 AD, like, the Roman Empire is collapsing, you know, and other empires across the continent are collapsing. Like, you have this like descent into the Dark Ages where pantheons are just disappearing from the world. And so what if you were actually playing, like, as a god during this time? Like, you're desperately trying to retain your power that you've had for so long, but you can see the end times coming. And, you know, spoiler alert, none of the gods make it. Like, it's that's it. they don't make it. But you're going to, you know, you're going to cling to what you have for as long as possible. And, you know, when we came up with that, I was like, okay, that's something that is good. Like, we can build off that. Like, Like, that is compelling because, you know, it's not just a fantastical story. It's a very human story, right? Like, you're trying to cling to life, like, for as long as you possibly can. Why should the gods that we create be any different? And so at that point I was like, okay, now this is something, like, this is something compelling. Like mm-hmm. I can really make that work.
Oh, that's awesome.
Plus now you can do a COVID-19 pandemic version of societal. Okay, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, what are the gods in that expansion? Technology, right. There's you have to summon internet trolls, I don't know what.
Yeah, so it's funny though, but so that was actually something we looked at, was like, okay, you know, there are all these pantheons out there in the world. Like, there's so much material for us to draw from, because so many games, you look at them, they're from the like Western European centric viewpoint, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's you either have Vikings, you have like conquistadors, or like it's always from that like Western European, you know, you have Rome, like it's always from that central area of Western Europe. And so one of the things when I was coming up with the, you know, with the new lore for the game was like, okay, we need to have part of that in there in order to hook players in. Like, the Greek and Roman pantheons are very well recognized in the Western mm-hmm. world, because that's what gets taught in, you know, in school. But there's nothing saying we can't draw from all these other experiences across the globe. Like, there are so many pantheons out there that people have believed in and that have then fallen by the wayside. So that, like, that's one of the big things about the game too, is that we're not just dealing with, okay, here's the Western European pantheons. Like, we're going to encompass the entire globe. Our one caveat is we will not do living religions. That is asking for trouble.
Yeah, that's
so any pantheon we include is probably in the dustbin of history.
That's interesting. In our last graphic novel club, we did a book called These Savage Shores by a creator named Ram V. Cadison, and Ram V is Indian, and so the book is set in 18th century India, but it's sort of a werewolf and vampire story, only it focuses on all these Eastern myths, origin myths, and things like that, and ancient unknown, unknowable things. And it's all about the life of India, what India is before a point in which it falls and what it's going to be afterwards. But it's one of the best and most interesting books I've read, you know, in the last 2 years. So that diversity is really cool.
Yeah. And that's something that we did with Twilight of the Gods, is that I got to know Shivam Barat, I think is his last name, a big magic community guy, talks a lot about diversity in the magic environment. And he's Indian. And so when we were coming up, you know, with these new cards, with these gods, like, I wanted to run by him, like, hey, like, what if we use these, you know, these symbols, what does that mean to you? Because we had a lot of originally, like, a lot of Hindu symbolism and like Hindu gods. And he, you know, I sent him an email like, hey, like, please give me your honest feedback, because I don't want people to be upset, like, when they see our game. And so he sent back like, hey, yeah, you know, using Hinduism is a bit like, it's problematic, because that's still a living religion. Like, those are still those are still gods that people worship. Like, they, you know, they have altars, they have shrines, like, they, you know, they are something that people believe in. But you can use the Vedic gods, like those are like the wellspring that the Hindu gods, you know, kind of came from. Like, those are sort of the pre-Hindu mythology of India. Like, and I was like, fantastic, we're changing all of them. Because again, like, it's not that hard to be cognizant of the fact that, like, you can potentially harm someone by putting in things that make them feel bad about themselves. And there are so many other options that we can use. And so, like, when he pointed that out, I'm like, it is not an issue for us to change these things. Like, I am glad you told me that. So, yeah, I hopefully any game designers listening to this, like, please reach out to people who are immersed in these cultures. If you're not immersed in those cultures, because that's how you learn. Like, that's how you understand new things. And we play games to have fun. Like, when you play a game, you shouldn't feel like, oh man, this makes me feel crappy because you know, it's making me feel bad about myself. Like, it's very easy to not have that happen. It just takes a little bit of work on your part.
Yeah, it's almost like issue of you know, color blindness and, you know, choosing colors for tokens and things like that. It's like it's pretty easy to avoid that if you just reach out to the people who know.
Yes. So that was something like I made a priority in Twilight of the Gods, was that all of the factions are both color coded and shape coded.
Nice.
So that way, like, if you're completely colorblind, you can still play the game because there is also a shape-coded symbol for your faction. Because again, like, I've seen so many stories from players who are like, I can't play this game because I can't tell the difference between these cards. And it's like, but there's such a simple solution to that. Like, if you spend the minuscule amount of time necessary to think about it. Like, and as a game designer, it's your job to think about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, as the actual blind member of this conversation, if you want blindness accessibility input, I can arrange that for you. So there's a company out of Texas called 64 Ounce Games. And back at the beginning of March, we did this big event at Paradox called It's Your Turn Game Day. And I am a member of the National Federation of the Blind. I'm a member of the North Dakota State affiliate, and I'm currently the acting fundraising chair. Well, I don't know anything about fundraising for an organization like that, but I know how to fundraise with board games. And so I'm like, we'll put these two together. And what we focused on, though, was making sure that everything we presented had a Braille version, was able to be played. What is the point of having an accessibility game day if the people that the event is for can't take part in it, right? And so these guys make Braille layovers of everything from Love Letter, Pandemic, Seven Wonders, you know, just all these, even like Apples to Apples. And I'm like, a game like Pandemic, there's Braille stickers to put on the board so you know what city you're going to and you can follow the path to the cities. All the cards are Brailled, and it's just fascinating. You know, now we didn't get many blind people to come play, but we raised about $2,000 for the NFB, and we had just a fantastic day. So everything you're talking about, like Twilight of the Gods, belongs in my store. And I'm wondering, you know, was it only Kickstarter? Is there a way I can get it? You know, if it's in distribution, I'm just not familiar.
Yeah. So you can order it online, I believe. I think Victory Points, I think Tabletop Tycoon still has the Victory Point website up where you can order it from. I will say, we don't have any blind accessible versions just because
that's okay.
Money.
Well, yeah. If you're interested, I can put you in touch. If you're ever interested when things are moving, I can put you in touch with Emily and Richard Gibbs, who own 64 Ounce Games. And I don't think it would be that hard to do. So,
oh yeah. Yeah. No, I would love to. Like, that is definitely something where it is a, that's more a publisher decision than a my decision, because like, sure. I want everyone to play our game. that is the idea behind the game, is that no matter who you are, you can play this game and find yourself represented in it. Unfortunately, we still live in a capitalist society. it just freaking sucks.
I think about that from the blind perspective. I say that a lot to myself or to others, is, you know, our buying power is not that high, right? So we don't represent enough of the marketplace usually to get, but you know,
right, which you again know, it sucks. Like, that's not the way things should be. Like, we should be able to let anyone who wants to play games play games. Like, they're supposed to be fun.
I'm able to play. I have vision in my right eye, and I use magnifiers on iPads and iPhones and other things, you know, in order to be able to play. It's hard for me to play board games. I can play card games pretty easily, you know, because I can get a card in front of a magnifier no matter what, right? I can't necessarily get the track, the next piece of track I need to lay on a ticket to ride board figure it out, right? So, but yeah, well, anyway.
Well, so hopefully that's something where, like, technology, if we invest in it correctly, can get us to that point where, like stuff like augmented reality, right? Like, it can be, okay, say you're wearing, you know, a pair of augmented reality glasses that, like, see the board for you and then tell you, okay, here's what you're looking at. Like, something like that would be an absolute boon to, you know, to blind people, because it's like, okay, it's now being described to me, you know, in aural terms, like, what my eyes would be looking at. Like, and for a board game in particular, like, that, I can't imagine that would be anything but good. But yeah, that's, unfortunately, I think that's, like, way down the priority list of what we're developing these technologies for.
Well, you know, last thing, your philosophy behind Twilight of the Gods resonates with me a lot. I thought that, and I still do, the idea I've got for It's Your Turn Game Day, you know, when I was 5, I was a blind kid having surgeries at the Mayo Clinic, and I found Spider-Man. I had vision in my right eye, but I didn't have any in my left eye, and we were trying to save that vision, and I would start getting, you know, a comic book here and a comic book there, or a coloring book, and so those characters were just things I latched onto and inspired me, but as I've met other blind kids or younger blind people, they're often not inspired. They didn't have that experience or find those things. And I just feel like if you play a board game on a Saturday night and you have a fun time and you do one cool thing and you feel good about that, on Monday morning, the opportunity you might have said no to, you might be open to saying yes to, right? Like, it's that simple. So I just, yeah, there you go.
Right, yeah, again, games should be fun. like when you play a game, you should walk away from it being like, no matter if you won or lost, like, I had a good time.
Yep.
Yeah.
Josh, do you have any other board game? I mean, we've talked a lot. I wanted to talk about your writing as well, and we just, you know, I don't want to take up all your night, though.
Oh, I got plenty of time. all you're doing is keeping me from going back and bugging Lance.
Yeah. Well,
you're a retired maybe we hunter. Want to. I mean, you know.
No, I'm sure, yeah, like you said, you could talk for hours about your game. I could probably ask you questions for hours about your game, but maybe in the interest of reaching all the topics here, we should go ahead and move on. But that just gives us an excuse to have you back sometime so we can talk more. So
more than happy to.
Let me ask you this real quick before we move on. Do you have any other game design ideas that are brewing right now, or are you focused mainly on creating more expansion content, or where are you at with your board game design world?
Yeah, so right now we're not working so much on Twilight of the Gods because we have pretty much like 2.5 years worth of material, like, essentially done at this point.
Right
now Now we're waiting for our publisher to actually, you know, figure out when it's going to get published. So there is a game that I've been working on with a friend of mine from Minnesota and a my brother, because, again, he's very good at breaking stuff. But this one's more of a it's like a tile placement slash meeple placement. It can be either cooperative or competitive. It's up to the players to decide. So there's opportunities to betray each other. And kind of the feel we're going for is, you know how in like in Alien, when they go through, like, they're going through the corridors of the spaceship, like, trying to root out the xenomorph? Like, the idea is that, like, you're on this ship and things have gone terribly wrong, but you don't know what it is. And so you have to, like, venture out from kind of where you wake up from, but things are just getting worse and worse and worse. So it's very much this, like, how do you balance the growing tension of, like, these horrible things that are happening versus what you need to accomplish? So that's probably our closest one to like actual like finished production quality at this point. We prototyped it and we tested at 2DCon in Minnesota in what was that? It would have been like 2017, 2018. So like that's we got really good feedback on it, and like the people who played it were like, this is really cool, when can I buy it? But again, unfortunately, a combination of me working on Twilight of Gods and then the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that will be the next one that comes out. But yeah, I'm very excited about that one, because the people who played it were like you could just see the interactions between the players where they're like, how do we get through this? Like how do we survive? You know, what's going on around us? And it was a lot of fun to watch, just from a developer standpoint.
Awesome. Well, you'll have to keep us posted on that.
Oh yeah, no, sure. Like as soon as that one's ready, I'm going to be blasting it out to the world. I really enjoy that one.
Excellent. Hey folks, co-host Josh Trumbo here, just popping in to let you know that the rest of this conversation will continue on the next episode of the DoxCast. We just had such a good time talking with Chris that we let it ride and ended up going quite long, and so we're making two episodes out of it. In the meanwhile, though, we hope that you will find us on ParadoxCNC.com, that you will connect with us on Facebook as Paradox Comics and Cards. We're also at ParadoxCNC on Twitter, ParadoxCNC on Instagram, and of course we have all sorts of fun and interesting things happening at the store, or just starting to pick up again with some events and testing the waters and things like that. So thank you so much for tuning in to this episode. We hope you enjoyed it. Really hope that you'll tune in and catch the rest of the episode next week. And until then, we'll see you on the next DoxCast.
This was a DoxCast. Hope you think it rocks cast. Oh, look at the clocks cast. Until next time, geek on.